This program was first broadcast on Arrow FM, Wairarapa's only community access media station, and shared on Access Media with the support of New Zealand On Air.
All right, hello New Zealand, welcome to another episode of Turn the Page. My name's Mark Pacey from the Wairarapa Archive. Today I've dug up three more stories of our past to share with you. On Monday, September 5th, 1983, Father Fitzgibbon made his way to the Ati Whakatū hut. He did the responsible thing and left a note to say he was camping in his tent a few hundred metres down the track. He spent the night there and the next day decided he wanted to see a bit more of the area. I decided to go to Jumbo. I thought I'd like to get a view. While up on the ridge, things started to change. The weather took a change for the worst. And the father was forced to retreat off the ridge and seek shelter below. Making his way down to a creek bed, he spent a miserable night hunkered down, unable to pitch his tent due to the terrain. Despite the condition, he did manage to get some sleep and woke early on Wednesday. By this stage, he was overdue and knew that people would be starting to look for him. I knew I would have been missed by 7 p.m. on Tuesday night when I should have been on duty. At 6:30 p.m., I looked at my watch and said, "Sorry, folks." Despite the conditions and the weather, Father Fitzgibbons never lost hope, buoyed by his faith. I knew people would be very worried and would pray, and I knew because I had a special feeling that prayers were being reached by God and he was sending them down to me. The father continued to walk along the creek when he at last came across a sign of civilization, a bridge spanning a river. It turned out to be the Waiohine River. He spent the night by the river and then tried to ignore the hunger that was becoming more prominent. He wanted to ration his food as he had no idea how long he would be in the bush for. Despite his best efforts, he gave in at 10:30 p.m. I had to eat and put my last teaspoon of lemon barley juice with a cup of water and had a tangelo. It filled me up. He woke at 5 a.m. on Thursday and made the decision to have the remainder of his rations to build his strength to try and make his escape from the bush. Dressing in the dark, he continued the journey. His map was of no use to him anymore. Having been wet from so many days, it was reduced to a sodden mess. At 7:30 a.m., he came to the Waiohine hut and made his way inside. Relieved that he had found shelter, he was disturbed when he had a look at the hut logbook. I read the logbook, and the last people that used this hut had been there in July. So I wrote in the book that I hoped I wasn't 2 months before anyone else came again. You've got to keep a sense of humour to keep your morale up. In the hut, Father Fitzgibbon found a supply of food and some coffee. While the porridge was quite palatable, the coffee was a little on the old side. It had gone lumpy and sticky, but I put it in the billy and had some coffee. To make it obvious that he was in the hut, the father made a white cross and put it outside so it could be seen from the air. He also left some other items that he hoped make it obvious where he was. The weather on that Thursday was miserable. It had rained all day. Turning in for the night, the priest hoped that this might be his last out in the bush. The next morning he awoke to a new sound, not one that is natural in the bush. It was the sound of a helicopter. The noise of the helicopter woke me up. I picked up the jersey I was going to signal with and put on my boots when Vince Duckett walked in through the hut door. It was a very emotional moment for both of us. To me, he represented all of the searchers. After a helicopter ride to Hood Aerodrome, he got to go home to his family in Carterton. On Saturday, a special service was held in the chapel at St. Raphael's Home of Compassion, where a grateful flock welcomed home their father. All right, I'm going to play you a piece of music. Now, I was trying this before, and I couldn't hear it, so hopefully this all works out nicely. I'm sure I'm just doing something wrong. I was going to play something else, but then I was reading in the news this morning that the great Bonnie Tyler is not very well. You can Google that one if you want to see what's going on there. So this is her probably most well-known hit. This is Total Eclipse of the Heart. Okay, no, it's not. It's still doing its thing. Just bear with me. Maybe someone's muted this. I'll just have a quick look. No, I do not know what's going on there. We will have to do that song for her next time. So this is probably going to be a shorter one, seeing as though there is no music to play. That's okay. Moving on. We'll stay positive. In 1985, as part of the 40th anniversary of the atomic bombings of Japan, we started looking into the history of the bombings. First, we looked at what many of us already knew and recounted the Allied side of the story. In 1945, the war was still waging across the world. Things changed in May when Germany surrendered and the war in Europe was over. This left Japan as the last member of the Axis powers that we were at war with. While Germany understood the concepts of surrender and what that would mean, in Japan they struggled with the idea. Surrender to them was deeply shameful, and they firmly believed that any occupying force would subject the civilian population to inhuman and barbaric treatment. The Americans and their allies were also struggling with how to end the war. With a country so against surrender and determined to fight until the last man, the idea of a full-scale invasion of the Japanese homelands was expected to cost many hundreds of thousands of lives. There had to be an easier way. And a heavily secretive project had been underway on a new weapon of immense power, the atomic bomb. This was the first. It was first successfully detonated on July 16, and the construction of two weapons progressed quickly thereafter. On August 6, the first bomb was loaded onto the B-29 Enola Gay and took off heading for Japan. The idea was to use these weapons against Japanese cities and force them into surrender. The bomb was dropped over the city of Hiroshima, and as a result, between 90 and 156,000 people were killed. The imprecise numbers were due to poor record-keeping of the time and nothing being left behind. 3 days later, a second bomb was dropped on the city of Nagasaki. Up to 80,000 were killed. The Americans had hoped that the Japanese would believe they had several of these bombs and would keep using them. The method worked, and Japan surrendered 6 days later. The war was over, and the Allies rejoiced. We all looked forward to our boys returning home. Few gave a thought to those that had been affected by the atomic bombs, the vast majority of them who were civilians. For the 40th anniversary, we took a different angle and started to ask the question, what was it like to be on the ground? An article published in the Times Age by Gwyneth Wright, a Wellington reporter in Hiroshima, painted that nightmarish picture for us. Unrecognizable creatures, barely human and maddened by pain and shock, fled the city, their clothes and skin burned and blasted from their bodies, their hands held out in front of them, skin peeling in strips, corpses clasping dead and blackened babies, carbonized bodies with hair, clothes and skin burned away. The human shape was all that remained. For years we had seen the photographs of the mushroom cloud over the cities. We saw them as symbols of achievement, but we had not given much thought of what it was like on the ground. By the time we were commemorating these events in August of 1985, the world had come a long way, but not always in humane achievements. In 1945, there were a handful of these horrific weapons. 40 years later, there were thousands. If nuclear war broke out between America and Russia, we could expect to see the devastation of Japan on a global level. Nagasaki survivor Toshiaki Sugino visited Masterton and met with Mayor Frank Cody. He recalls staggering out from a concrete factory he was working in which had survived the blast to see what remained of his city. There was nothing there, nothing but smoking ruins. I thought, this isn't real. It had to be a dream. Or maybe I died and gone to hell. It looked like hell. It was hell. He had been working with a crew of 150. Just 10 survived. Wired Upper Schools marked the occasion with school children making paper cranes, a tribute to bomb survivor Sadako Sasaki, who had been diagnosed with leukemia from radiation from the bomb. She made the gallant attempt to fold 1,000 paper cranes, which, if completed, would grant you a wish. Her wish was to live. She completed 644, and then she died. All she wanted was a chance to live a normal life, but for her and thousands of others, they never got that chance. If the initial blast didn't kill them, the long-term effects of the radiation did, and they died a slow and painful death. Now, 80 years on, people all over the world helped Sadako complete her last task. She did not receive her wish, but because of her story, people know the horrible effects that atomic war has. Folding cranes for her reminds us of what happened in the past, a past we need to remember and understand to stop it from ever happening. No one should ever have to experience another Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And then there would be an interlude when we play a piece of music, but we're not going to do that. That's all right. Next time we'll play more, maybe. All right, last story. In the early 1900s, it was felt by some that Carterton needed a town clock. In 1906, a real effort was made to get the town a clock of its own. A three-day fair was organised, mainly by the three Carterton lodges at the time, the Druids, the Foresters, and the Oddfellows. An inquiry was made to England for the new timekeeper, and it was costed at £700, equivalent of around $150,000 today. The clock would be made by Joyce and Company in Whitchurch. Whitchurch? Yeah, that's right. I struggle with some of these English names sometimes. It's probably pronounced entirely different, but let's call it Whitchurch. And the bells by John Taylor of Loughborough. The clock and bells were to be installed in the Carterton Post Office, which had opened in 1903. By January 1907, the clock and bells had arrived in New Zealand. On Wednesday night, March 27, 1907, Carterton's mechanical heart started beating. For 35 years, the ticking remained strong, but then it was brought to an abrupt stop. On June 24, 1942, a massive earthquake struck the region. There was extensive damage throughout, and the post office was one of the victims. The tower was deemed too badly damaged and was dismantled. The clock and bells were put in storage. And there they lay for the next two decades. During the 1950s, the Carterton Borough Council had the clock and bells valued, and they were agreed on that they were too valuable to keep in storage. They deserved a chance to tick and toll again. Mayor Ronald Wakeland was keen to see the clock take pride of place in the town. In my opinion, it adds dignity and mana to our borough, and in spite of the events of wristwatches, I will guarantee that everybody will be having a look-see. In 1962, Rig Shockey was awarded the contract to build the tower and began construction. Bolt and Sutherland of Wellington had the job of getting the clock mechanism up and running again. The clock had been in storage for 20 years and had been moved four times, but it was still in good condition, and despite its eventful history and only once a component of the clock... This is why you check your notes, people. And only one component of the clock had been lost. The tower began to take shape throughout 1962, and on September 26, the big day came. Carterton's ticking heart beat once more. Mayor Wakeland unveiled a commemorative plaque, and the clock and the tower were declared open. The new tower rose 45 feet above High Street. On the inside, it was divided into four levels, separated by hatches with ladders taking you from level to level. The third level housed the bells, and the fourth, there was the clock. In 2019, refurbishment work was started on the tower and the clock. The tower was strengthened against any future earthquakes, and the mechanism was given an overhaul, although the whole process was delayed because of the arrival of COVID-19. The clock remained silent while this work was being carried out, but on January 30th, 2021, the mechanical heart of Carterton, housed in a newly strengthened and repainted tower, started beating once again. All right, so I did find a joke. Obviously, I'm not going to joke about the first two stories. That's just, I'm not even going to go there. So I had a quick Google. Say, what are some jokes about clocks and time? And I found this one. It was appropriate with the low bar that we have set ourselves with the puntastic things we do. What did the second hand say to the minute hand? I'll see you in a minute. Ah, it's good. That's so good. Feel free to tell your friends that one. Right, that is me done for the day. Sorry, I couldn't play you any of my music. Maybe you're happy. I do play some strange stuff. We will catch up with you again on Monday. All things going well. There's no holidays. Sometimes I get that wrong. If it's a holiday, I won't be here. If it's a regular day, I should be, unless I'm crook. But either way, have a brilliant week. Stay warm, and we will see you then. Catch you later.